This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. It's been a few months since the City of Orlando rolled out its new ordinance regarding vacation rentals. The law aims to regulate properties that are being rented out through sites like Airbnb in one of the most visited cities in the country and allay the fears of neighbours in residential areas who aren't pleased by the rotating cast of visitors next door. But some Airbnb owners say the ordinance, which includes rules like ensuring the owner lives on property and is there when guests are staying, is not fair. We're going to hear from the city planner about how Orlando's rolling out these new rules and other cities it's looking to for inspiration. But first, we talk to Jenny Morrison, who owns a property in Orlando which she rents out through Airbnb and which is a major part of her family's income.
I own a property in downtown Orlando. It's a whole house, bungalow style, where lots of families come and they live like a local.
When did you buy that house?
A few years ago.
And did you buy it with the purpose of setting it up as a short-term rental property?
Absolutely.
So there has been some back and forth with the city council about how they are going to regulate these. What is your understanding of the latest? Like, how does the law work for you?
I didn't hear of the new legislation until the City of Orlando sent me quite a threatening letter recently that said they were going to levy costly fines against me every day until I shut down my Airbnb. They gave me 30 days to comply and said that the new law states they don't want any entire home Airbnbs in the city limits of Orlando. It was a little scary.
So essentially, if you want to run an Airbnb, you would have to be living there yourself.
Correct. And we don't live there. We bought that property just to be exclusively an Airbnb.
Now, when you bought it, were there any rules or any regulations about how you could run an Airbnb or anything like what the city is looking at now?
Not that I know of. In fact, I even talked to the city about it, and Orange County and the city and the state of Florida already have a system in place for short-term rentals for taxation, and they've just been collecting tax on it the entire time. So they've been profiting off of short-term rentals.
What did those regulations, when you bought it, what did they say?
I didn't think there was a whole lot regulating short-term rentals at that time. I know the state was trying to pass something, or has been trying to pass something, that property owners should be able to rent out their property as they please.
What does this mean for you now then? Are you going to have to shut things down? What are your plans?
This is really scary for our family. We just had a baby. This is a huge part of our income. This is how we pay our bills. Mm-hmm. So now we've got 30 days to cancel a year's worth of bookings, break tons of people's hearts, to sell everything in the house, and not sure what we're going to do with the property now. Either way, it's not going to be easy for our family.
You can't be the only property owner in this situation, though.
No, I'd imagine it's many, many property owners in the city of Orlando.
So have you talked to some of those other property owners?
I haven't yet. I hope to.
Are you kind of resigned to having to do what you just said, though, like sell up and move on? Or are you thinking that there might be a way through this, a way to negotiate with the city?
I was hoping to get Airbnb on our side to have them kind of fight against the city a little bit, kind of the same way Uber did when City of Orlando tried to shut down Uber. And Uber took the driver's backs. But Airbnb told us just to go ahead, comply with local laws, and kind of gave us a copy-pasta answer. And hopefully they'll come and rally to our cause, because...
Jenny Morrison, tell me about the kinds of people who book a stay in this house. You said you've got a year's worth of bookings?
Yeah, it's generally families that want to live like a local. It's a lot of people that want to travel with their dogs, mm-hmm, and their kids, and they want to pay low prices to have a whole backyard that their dogs and kids can play in. And they're generally not the folks who want to go live the Disney thing here in Orlando. They'd stay on Disney property if they wanted to do that. These are the people that want to go to Dr. Phillips Center and eat and live and play near downtown Orlando.
Mm-hmm. And what's the typical length of stay?
Typical length is probably around 3 to 7 days.
Mm-hmm. I guess when you talk to residents, some of their concerns might be, we don't like the idea of a rotating cast of neighbors kind of coming in and coming out. We're not quite sure who's going to be next to us one day to the next. So can you sort of understand why people might have concerns about that?
Absolutely. And each Airbnb owner gets to set their own house rules. And our house rules include things like no parties. And that deters an entirely different group of Airbnb guests. Mm-hmm. Or no noise after 10 p.m. because it's in a residential neighborhood. Although my residential neighborhood that this Airbnb is in is mostly other rentals and also a lot of other Airbnbs and short-term rentals, it really attracts a particular crowd that is dog owners and families.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any complaints from any neighbors in the time you've had the Airbnb running?
Not one.
I'm wondering if there's other cities where they've gone through a similar kind of situation and resolved things in a way that everybody can agree with. And like, have you sort of looked at what other cities have done to come up with some ideas for how the city of Orlando might proceed if they decide to change things up?
I know quite a few cities have banned Airbnbs, kind of like city of Orlando has. I know most Airbnb owners are waiting on the state of Florida to pass this legislation that if it's your property, you can rent it out as you please, which hopefully will override city of Orlando.
That doesn't really help you, though. I mean, you need the law now.
I need help now. It's going to be really tough for us. I think it's a shame what the city of Orlando is doing. It's massive overreach to tell people what they can and can't do with their property. And I think it's going to have consequences that maybe they didn't think of, economic consequences. And, you know, who was there when tons of Puerto Rican refugees were flooding into Orlando and they needed short-term housing? People went to Airbnbs. We were booked out for months.
You had a lot of Puerto Rican evacuees staying at your house?
For months. And, you know, we could accommodate whole families, kids, pets. I think it's going to have huge consequences for the city if they really want to push this.
Jenny Morrison, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Matt.
For more on how the city is implementing these new rules, we're joined by Chief Planner Jason Burton. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to meet you today.
I wonder if you could sort of lay out what the city is doing to institute some regulations for Airbnbs within city limits.
Certainly, this is part of what we would call the sharing economy, and basically, larger cities or more forward-thinking cities are looking at how to regulate the sharing economy and have less impacts to neighbors. And obviously, since it involves technology, it's really evolving. But there are a lot of community concerns about whether it's a loss of a neighbor or there being a party house that moves next door, to even impacts on housing affordability in a region that arguably has a lot of tourists visiting, I think 72 million at last count. So those are all concerns that have neighborhood compatibility concerns, if you will. So what we went ahead and did is looked at our peer cities throughout the country, Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, even Nashville and New Orleans have grappled with short-term rentals and how it may or may impact neighbors and how they would regulate it going forward. So we looked at some of our better cities like Denver and Fort Lauderdale locally in the state of Florida, for example. And what we've discovered is that in order to control for neighborhood concerns, the best solution in a residential zoning district is to have what we call a hosted visit. In other words, the whole entire unit doesn't flip over and there's nobody there supervising it. And it deals with all those exacerbating concerns that can arise with short-term rentals. The other thing I'd note is that the city has been regulating short-term rentals since 1991 when we had a consolidated land development code. And we did not allow for short-term rentals less than 30 days. So basically, we're seeing this as an expansion of accommodating the sharing economy in the end. So we basically split the baby and provided for an avenue for residents to actually do some short-term rentals. And it addresses not only housing affordability, but allows people to have their own cottage industry as a resident to afford those high rents or their mortgage and basically have visitors visit our traditional city and the city of Orlando. So we're seeing that as a positive so they can visit our main streets and downtown and whatnot.
The bottom line, though, Jason, is that you can't rent out an entire house. The homeowner has to be living in the house when they rent it out using Airbnb or a similar home sharing website.
Correct. You can do that as a commercial dwelling unit, but they're restricted to certain zoning districts where you would normally find multifamily, hotel and motel uses and more intense types of uses where we think it's appropriate to have those types of uses. And in other areas that are residential, we think there are too many compatibility concerns with having entire units being leased out on a short-term basis essentially taking it out of a residential use and putting it into more of a commercial type of use. And again, it has other concerns and raises other issues, whether, you know, are you going to actually have home ownership opportunities for residents? Are you going to have leasable units that are available so it doesn't exacerbate our housing crisis? And of course, those impacts to other neighbors. So we're still providing an avenue that our residents can actually lease out those things, but it's an accessory use to an actual residential use rather than placing an entire commercial use within a residential zoning district.
Have you had some feedback from people who maybe are renting out entire homes, you know, kind of concerned about these new rules? Because we at WMFE, we've spoken to one homeowner who said they got a letter saying essentially they've got 30 days to sort things out. They bought a house as kind of an investment to rent out, and now they've been told they need to basically stop doing that per this ordinance, which kicked in July 1st. So how much outreach has the city done to kind of let people know about this rule?
Well, there has been a lot of concerns raised, certainly, but when we passed this ordinance, we did quite a bit of outreach and took a field a lot of phone calls and whatnot. But one thing that we did do is we worked with Airbnb directly to send emails to all of their operators within the city of Orlando to inform them of our HomeShare website, cityoforlando.gov/HomeShare, where people can go in and find those rules out. So there was direct messaging, if you will, from Airbnb, because they supported us expanding short-term rental rights within our city. The other thing that we did is that we started to send out letters, because we've started to identify the actual address of people that are using the various platforms and documenting that on a weekly and monthly basis, so we can use that for future code enforcement. So we've sent out 404 letters. We're trying to do it in different phases, so people have gotten letters that say exactly what they need to be doing and how they might need to register if they're going to continue to do short-term rentals. But the ordinance is designed so that people don't essentially go in and buy up entire blocks, if you will, of residential uses and turn them into short-term hotels in a residential zoning district. So it is designed to prevent that, and just to note, they haven't been able to do that since 1991. So that has been in place for some time. And obviously, we're a tourism destination, and there has been restrictions on that within our residential zoning district for quite a while.
I guess, Jason, probably the reason you're seeing more people, you know, renting out parts or entire homes in some cases now is because there are these sort of new apps like Airbnb, which allows people, it kind of gives people a platform to do that, whereas perhaps they might not have kind of thought about that in the past, right?
Yeah, they may not have thought about it in the past. They may not, I mean, zoning rules are not the first thing that people think about when they're participating in the sharing economy, but, you know, we did want to provide an avenue that we think is reasonable, that really benefits individual households that are trying to afford the property values and rents that we have in our city. So we see that as a positive. But when you're starting to take off on every block, you know, if you look at some of these websites, if there's one home or two homes on every block within the city of Orlando, that kind of exacerbates our affordable housing crisis within our city, and also has neighborhood compatibility concerns, which is something that I think your show has explored pretty frequently. So those are things that put extreme pressures on our housing affordability, and that's one of the reasons why we're enforcing what we're doing.
Can I ask then about the 404 letters? Do I take it to mean that there are 404 situations where somebody is renting out an entire house using a website or an app like Airbnb?
Well, right now our estimates are somewhat, you know, because people are on multiple platforms, but we've discovered that most people that are on a platform are usually on Airbnb in itself. Usually the figure can be about 95%. But right now, with our consultants, we've identified about 1,336 actual individual properties within the city of Orlando that are advertising on different various platforms. We've identified the addresses for about 855 of those, and since we're doing this in phases, we started with a lot of our residential zoning districts where a lot of the concerns seem to be coming from a neighborhood compatibility perspective. So we've sent out that first phase of 404 letters, and we'll be following up with subsequent phases and notices of violation for folks that haven't, you know, come into compliance, either stopped advertising inconsistent with the ordinance or have managed to register. So that takes a whole entire code enforcement process, and the first time that we're probably going to be considering that at our code enforcement board is in December. So we're giving people ample time since July, if you will, when we put this ordinance in effect to expand short-term rental rights within the city, that people can come in compliance and at least conform to the code requirements. Of course, it's new, and people want to participate in the sharing economy, so we're giving everyone ample opportunity to kind of come to compliance.
Are you saying they have until December to comply?
No, I'm saying that if you're in this first batch of folks or first phase that we're taking to code board, they would need to, you know, come into compliance, and they probably have some time to get into compliance. But as soon as you're starting to getting notices and you're getting your hearing scheduled for code enforcement board, people not only perform a little bit more, but they're starting to realize what actually needs to happen and what is legal within the city. So there's a lot of folks that inquire, obviously. I think in the past couple of weeks, we've had over 200 people inquire individually on what they can and cannot do. So we're, you know, hopefully doing a good job of informing them of what is actually legal within the city.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to the Chief Planner for the City of Orlando, Jason Burton, talking about the city's home sharing ordinance. Jason, I wonder if I could ask you then, you know, what does a letter say? What does it tell these property owners they need to do?
Oh, I don't have it right in front of me, but one of the basic things is citing the ordinance and then telling them that they have, you know, some time to get into compliance. And then also pointing them to the website where we register and have more information on home sharing and what is expected of them, essentially, and what all the requirements of that is. So all those things are contained in the letter, and it's kind of self-explanatory that they need to come into compliance. I think a lot of people, unless the city informs them about it, if they're doing something illegal, they're going to continue to do that in the sharing economy. But we want to actually make them aware of what's happening with our changes in our ordinance and making sure that they have the correct information so they can come into compliance.
If you did own a home and you're renting the entire thing out, though, and you got one of these letters, what would your options be? Like, would you have to sell the house? Would you have to move into it yourself if you wanted to keep renting it out?
Well, one thing that we do allow is we do allow tenants to participate in the sharing economy with actual homeowners, if you will. So it's called a home-occupied or owner-occupied home-sharing ordinance, but we do have the option that if you do want to put a permanent tenant in there and they could actually rent out portions of the home for home sharing, they can. One thing that we do have that's a hallmark of the ordinance is that you have to have a subordinate amount of rooms being leased out to short-term renters. So, for example, if you had a three-bedroom home, you could only rent out one room because it's less than 50% of that particular home. So we're trying to keep that home, if you will, on the rental market for our residents. And of course, those people that are actually hosting folks are dealing with the neighborhood compatibility concerns, making sure that somebody of responsibility is there for that particular property. Most of the people that are doing that are going to be actual homeowners themselves, we've discovered, but at least it provides the opportunity with the property owner's permission to have tenants actually lease out to short-term renters as well.
Right. So just to be clear, you would need somebody who is not a short-term renter to kind of be the
host. Yeah, they would have to be the host. And, you know, it helps with people visiting from, you know, all the different countries that we have from around the world visiting. But, you know, those hosts can be a guide, if you will, towards, you know, what's happening in town, our urban main streets, our downtown, and various places like that. And certainly, Orlando is the central city of Central Florida, and we are interested in having more people, you know, come to our downtown, enjoy our nightclubs, our nighttime economy, our main streets, places like Audubon Park, the Eastman Market, and whatnot. Those are really interesting places that we would like to see more visitors towards. And we're discovering that people that are actual residents can guide that a little bit better than just people that are visiting to go visit the theme parks or whatnot.
Was this the way that the likes of Denver or Fort Lauderdale kind of moved forward with this issue? You mentioned some of those cities which have tackled how to regulate short-term rentals the idea of having a host resident or a host renter in one of these properties?
Yeah, since the host themselves is the best code enforcement that the city can hope for, if you will, they're the people that will make sure and they're there with their neighbors every day and the social pressures of making sure that people aren't knocking on the wrong doors in the middle of the night or partying late into the evening. They're going to make sure, because they're living there, that the guests behave, for lack of a better term. So Denver, I think we're following the Denver model on how they're operating a similar type of hosted strategy for residential zoning districts. In most commercial or mixed-use zoning districts that we have within the city, we can consider different commercial dwelling units where you are turning over the entire unit. Those types of areas are a little bit more intense than residential zoning districts, so you're not disturbing your neighbors, if you will, as much, because you're expected to have a little bit more activity. In places like downtown Orlando, you could potentially have one of those commercial dwelling units.
Is that something that the city's considering, maybe changing the zoning for some areas?
We don't typically consider changing the zoning for a particular use or spot zoning in the middle of a residential neighborhood. But I will say that a lot of our zoning districts are mixed-use zoning districts that are, we don't have necessarily commercial zoning districts, but we allow for residential in a lot of our commercial areas, and we have since 1985. And we were one of the first jurisdictions in the United States to do that. So we're a little bit more mixed-use by right to allow for zoning districts that allow for residential development, and that's why you see a lot of folks or developers building different types of mixed-use projects throughout our city in our more intense activity centers, whether it's College Park or downtown or SoTo or any of those locations. You'll see a lot of different types of more intense urban development as our city grows up.
If I am a short-term rental owner and I get one of these letters saying come into compliance and I don't comply, what happens then? Do I get fined?
You could potentially be fined. Now, the code enforcement board themselves, if you got an initial letter, there'd probably be a follow-up letter giving you that date of when you'd be expected to go before the code enforcement board. And, of course, we mentioned earlier, the earliest we're looking at that would be December of this year for our first phase of folks that have been informed. So there would be a follow-up letter giving them an idea of when they would be subject to coming before the code enforcement board, which is something that happens on the second Wednesday of the month, I believe, and they'd be notified of that hearing, and they could come in and plead their case to the code enforcement board. And the code enforcement board has some discretion to go ahead and do a compliance schedule with them or actually assess a fine and find them guilty of violating the zoning code, for lack of a better term. They do that for not only the zoning code, but they do that for other various building code violations and things like that. That our code enforcement officers are used to dealing with. So they build cases and then they present that evidence to the code enforcement board, and with the preponderance of evidence, they render a decision.
It sounds like there's still quite a bit of work to do as far as getting everybody notified, any of these property owners who do have these short-term rentals. Are you kind of anticipating, Jason Burton, that everything is going to be squared away and sorted out by the end of the year, or is it going to take a bit longer than that?
It's going to take a little bit longer than that because there are, upwards of 1,200 plus properties within the city. It'd be impractical for us to bring all 1,200 folks before a code enforcement board, so we're anticipating that folks will either stop advertising and consistent with the ordinance, they'll register and come in compliance and do it correctly, or there might be those few outliers that we might need to take before a code enforcement board. So that's why we started with our residential neighborhoods first and moving on to our more of our multifamily types of areas and our mixed-use areas, if you will, to take that in phases so we're not overwhelming folks and they have a fair chance of the due process of going through the code enforcement process as well. And, of course, for the own practicality of us processing those registrants into our new system. That's at orlando.gov/homeshare. So that's really important for us to make sure that people are getting the information and giving Apple time to come into compliance.
Jason Burton is the chief planner with the City of Orlando. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me today.
Still to come, how do the midterms look from the I-4 corridor? We're joined by Orlando Sentinel politics editor Steve Lemongello. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the final month before the midterm elections, candidates are crisscrossing the state of Florida, shoring up their base and trying to get their message out to undecided voters. Joining us to talk more about the home stretch of this election season is the Orlando Sentinel's politics editor, Steve Lemongello. It's a very interesting midterm election. How do you feel about this?
Oh, it's amazing. The fact that we have, you know, both the very rarely aligned thing of the governor's race and a incredibly competitive Senate race happening at the same time. It's just make things, you know, extra nuts. Plus, of course, you have all these various competitive congressional races up and down the state, too.
Which ones are you paying the most attention to aside from the big ones like the Senate and the governor's race? They are kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the room in some ways, but you mentioned those other competitive races. Are there some that really stick out for you specifically here in Central Florida that people should be paying more attention to than they maybe are?
Oh, sure. Well, here in Central Florida, the most competitive race is the one in District 7. That makes up all of Seminole County and parts of Orange County between U.S. Representative Stephanie Murphy and State Representative Mike Miller. That's a very, very competitive seat. It's labeled evenly split by Cook Political Report, the actual, you know, seat in district itself, which is very rare. Usually, those districts usually lean one way or another. Murphy right now is a bit of the favorite, according to Cook and a lot of other analysts. You know, but Mike Miller, he has a strong name recognition. You know, he won a Hillary Clinton leaning seat to state Senate in the Winter Park area for the last few election cycles. So he has a pretty good chance.
You mentioned the kind of leaning of that one, and I do note that some endorsements she's gotten suggest that maybe she could be the favorite. For example, Chamber of Commerce is throwing their weight behind Stephanie Murphy, which is kind of an indication that they think that's where the race is going.
Yeah, that is very rare for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to endorse a Democrat. I think she and a Democrat from Bergen County, New Jersey, are the only Democratic congresspeople I've seen that the U.S. Chamber has endorsed in the last few months. The U.S. Chamber, of course, spends very heavily on Republicans. They spent backing Rick Scott in the Senate race, for example. So the fact that the U.S. Chamber feels comfortable wanting to endorse Stephanie Murphy, you know, may show where they see that race going.
I wonder what you made of the debate between Senator Bill Nelson and his challenger, Governor Rick Scott. It was taped, I guess, in the midday hours, rebroadcast later on. Kind of interesting timing there. And it was on Telemundo, so reaching out to the Hispanic vote in Florida. What was your takeaway from that debate?
That was a very interesting debate, both sides trying to essentially define the other, you know, negatively. From what we've seen from polls, including Quinnipiac, there seems to be not too much, you know, independent or not too much people haven't made up their mind in that race. They seem to, everyone seems to know these people. These guys have both been in office for a very long time. You know, Scott, you know, not so much long as Nelson has, but, you know, 8 years as governor, people get to know you. Most of the people's minds seem to be made up. There is that sort of, you know, slight group, in the middle there that everyone's trying to go after, especially the, you talk about the fact that the debate was on Telemundo. The Hispanic community in Florida is the real prize for Nelson or Scott. Nelson has not been as strong as other Democrats have been. Scott, meanwhile, has a bit of strength in the Hispanic community, especially in the Puerto Rican community, more than other Republicans, especially following Hurricane Maria and the steps that, you know, Scott has done to help with evacuees there. But, Nelson, you know, he was endorsed the other day by the governor of Puerto Rico, who is a Democrat, but has sort of equivocated back and forth for like months about whether to support Scott or Nelson or whether he'll support anybody, even after his own father, also a former governor of Puerto Rico, endorsed Nelson in June. He gave Nelson his full support last week, though he did go out of his way to say he's nothing negative about Scott, called Scott a friend, but he said that he just thinks that Nelson would be the better choice. So that seems to be, and Nelson's numbers among Hispanics seems to be improving a little bit, over the last, couple months or so, since some polls earlier in the summer showed him, behind with Hispanic voters, well behind Scott.
There has been a lot of talk, too, about the potential impact of new arrivals from Puerto Rico to Central Florida and whether those folks, first of all, are going to register to vote and then who they might vote for. What do you make of that particular aspect of the race?
Well, we have looked over the last year or so at, you know, what the numbers are in terms of registration for people from Puerto Rico. It's not as strong as people would think. People seem to assume that everyone would be coming here. People would be coming here, you know, leaving a very devastated island, trying to get their lives back together. And then the first thing they would do is, you know, go and register to vote. That's not the first thing they're thinking of. They're trying to, you know, piece their lives together. That's the first thing. The second thing is that also there seems to be a thought that they will all suddenly, you know, register Democrat, and that will be sort of, you know, leading into a huge blue wave. Now, the Puerto Ricans in Florida have tended to, you know, vote to lean Democratic, you know, in elections. But at the same time, the majority of them tend to identify and register as independents and NPAs, in nonpartisan affiliation in elections. So there's not that sort of huge surge of Puerto Rican Democrat voters that people think was going to happen. Now, there still could be. Trump is very unpopular in the Puerto Rican community here in Florida, especially after his recent remarks saying the death toll was a fraud and also saying that the response to Maria was, you know, hugely successful. But there are a large group of, you know, people in the Puerto Rican community who do back Scott, who do back Republicans, you know, if not, you know, huge fans of Trump so much. While there could be a sense of Democrats, you know, getting some, you know, numbers and voters out of that group of voters, you know, I don't think it's going to be that huge surge of, you know, a bunch of new voters that people thought.
Steve Limangiello, speaking of another fairly tight race in Florida, of course, the gubernatorial race, you have Andrew Gillum on the Democratic side and then Ron DeSantis on the Republican side. Not too much between those two candidates. Do you think there's one issue which is really going to be make or break for this race?
I don't think there's going to be one particular issue that's make or break, especially since you're seeing the same sort of thing with that you're seeing in the Senate race, where it seems people seem to have made up their minds. A lot of people seem to have made up their minds. While in the Senate race, you know, both candidates have, you know, a long history. People know them. It's sort of the opposite in the governor's race. You know, Gillum and DeSantis weren't really that well known outside of their district or their city like a couple of years ago. But at the same time, their positions are just so vastly different when it comes to their records and their positions that there's really not going to be so much of a large group of, you know, independents who's going to be making a difference there. People always say it's going to come out to turnout, but it really will come out to turnout. Gillum has to get out younger people and African-Americans, and DeSantis really has to hope that the Trump turnout that came out in 2016, like, you know, large numbers in, you know, more rural counties will come out for him. That's pretty much it. Both sides are just trying to, you know, play to their base. But usually after primaries, both sides try to, you know, come to the middle after playing to their bases for the primaries. But pretty much this year, both sides are playing to their bases for the general election, too. They want to get out their voters, and they're essentially trying to, you know, outdraw the other side when it comes to, you know, getting out their vote.
Steve Limangiello, the politics editor for the Orlando Sentinel, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, former record store owner and DJ Hannah Scrubco talks about some of her favorite singles, from the Rolling Stones to Daft Punk. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In August this year, Hannah and Roman Scrubco sold the record store they'd owned since the 1970s. East West Music and More has been an Orlando fixture, surviving the decline and comeback of vinyl, the death and resurrection of the cassette, and the rise and fall of the big box music store. The store is still there, just under new ownership. When Hannah Scrubco first started East West, many of the records she sold, she was spinning as a DJ.
Album that featured the Andy Warhol cover with a zipper in the front. But for me, we used this music to make our first commercial on commercial radio, WORJ-FM.
Uh-huh.
I went in, we loved the instrumental rejoinder in the middle of this, and we used that for a commercial. We just love the music.
Yeah.
And no sooner had I walked out of the studio when I was offered a job on the radio, baby.
So that's how you got your first gig as a DJ?
It is, and I owe it to this song.
Wow.
Every time I hear it, it just energizes me.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that job you had as a DJ.
Oh, best job ever. Best people, best job. I was the first full-time female disc jockey in this market.
Wow.
I know.
And how long did you have that job for?
Well, with WORJ until my program director left, which is, I'm going to say, 2 years. And then I left because he left. And then I was hired back about 2 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
So on and off for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And did you play a lot of Rolling Stones?
You betcha, baby. You bet. We play a lot of everything. We were a deep, deep, deep non-commercial radio station.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those scenarios where I would call my music director and say, I'm bringing in Patti Smith and Atomic Rooster and, you know, this Stones and that and this and that. And he'd say, sure, you own a record store. You know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you see the Rolling Stones perform live?
Oh, many, many times, yeah. The last time was last year when they were here in Orlando, and it was as electrifying as anything I've ever seen.
They've been around so long, they've still got it?
50 years, and, you know, I hadn't seen them for maybe 20 years before that, so I was kind of scared. They were amazing, amazing, amazing. And to me, it's like going to church. You're going up and you're watching these 70-year-olds rock their hearts out, and you go, there's hope. There's hope for us all.
All right, moving on to another track from the 70s, Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Hannah Skrubko, what does this song mean to you?
This song means the world to me, literally the world. I got into world music via Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Mm-hmm.
Just before this album was released, we were lucky enough to see a screening for The Harder They Come. At our particular screening, in a theater in Pine Hills, no less, Chris Blackwell was the one who introduced. Chris Blackwell is the man who founded Island Records. He was a very young pisher back then, just like us. And he got up and said, here's a movie about Jamaica. This is the way I see Jamaica. This is what's going on right now. And that movie just went, and then like literally seconds later, that first Bob Marley, Catch a Fire, was put in our hands, and we were never the same after that.
How popular was that record, and how much did Bob Marley do to popularize reggae?
Huge, massive, massive thing. It was kind of the first music that was not quintessentially American to break through the pop market. Everything up till then had been either American or American influence, British, you know.
Get up, stand up,
get up, stand up,
don't give up the fight.
Life is your right.
Let's move on from the 70s and talk about some of the songs from the 80s. And I want to start with this track. Tell me about this record. When did you first hear this, and what did you think when you heard it?
MTV. MTV changed the landscape forever. Early MTV, when it first came on, the first three, 4 years that it was on television, literally made record stores bring televisions into their shops so we could see what the latest video of whoever is. Cyndi Lauper was a brand new artist, and she was breathtaking. She was so colorful and vivid and devil may care. And she was also girl empowering. And it wasn't just about having fun. It was just about girls.
Did you sell a lot of these records?
Tons. And we continue to sell this.
Now, was this an MTV band, The Replacements?
No, not at all. This was a record store band. Every kid who worked in a record store became obsessed with The Replacements. It wasn't quite punk. It wasn't proto-punk. It wasn't anything. It was just kind of in-your-face, jagged garage music. The Replacements were astounding. And the fact that they wrote a song about another icon, Alex Chilton, it was just a perfect song by a perfect band at the perfect time.
Did you listen to a lot of punk as well?
I did. I couldn't not listen to punk. It was, remember, it was the 80s, so many of us were railing against the man, the same way young people rail against the man then. But then the man was Mr. Trickle-Down Economics, Mr. This, That, and the Other. You know, it was economically, the U.S. was going through a very hard time. Punk music was the only way we could rage creatively. I don't know if you've ever been in a mosh pit. I don't know if you've ever seen like a really good hardcore show and just watch bodies slamming against each other. It's a thing of true beauty because there's so much violence and no one gets hurt.
Ideally, no one gets hurt.
Yeah, that's true. Ideally, no one gets hurt. You won't see this girl in a mosh pit, but I loved watching.
Hannah Skrobko, let's jump ahead now to an era I'm more familiar with, which is the 90s. And I want to start with a track by Pearl Jam called Alive. Pearl Jam.
The first time I heard young Eddie Vedder's voice, it was like I heard the voice of God for the first time. I was overwhelmed by the epic splendor of Pearl Jam and how something could be so simple and cathedral-esque at the same time. Their first two records were so, you know, they were just all-encompassing. They sucked you in. The music out of the Pacific Northwest during that time was like that. It was like they were so isolated that the only way that they could get you to them is by sucking you in with their glory and their epicness.
What was it about this era, this music, grunge, that kind of kicked off the 90s, though, and I guess said goodbye to the 80s?
For me, I'm going to have to say that a lot of people were really upset by grunge music. A lot of die-hard, normal rock dudes resisted like crazy at all of it. We went from glam, we went from glitter to, you know, utility wear and Dickies pants and combat boots and plaid. Lots of plaid.
Was Orlando kind of in step with the times as far as seeing people pick up that fashion and listen to that music?
Yeah, yeah, it was. Because Orlando, despite its kind of transient nature, always had a really good bunch of record stores supporting everything. And at the time, during that time, we had distributors and labels that supported record stores. It was to end in about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. But at that time, they were still with us. They were still hanging in.
Well, something a little different from Pearl Jam and that whole music scene from the Pacific Northwest. This is a song by Lauryn Hill called Doo-Wop.
Yo, remember back on the Bully when cats used to harmonize like, my men and my women, don't forget about the dean. This is not the most of king, yo. It's about a thing,
Drumming on the table, they're really getting into it.
Lauryn Hill, and actually it started with the Fugees, but the Lauryn Hill record was so profoundly important to me. I literally started every day for a year and a half with that record.
This is in your record shop?
Oh, of course. On vinyl and CD. But of course, yeah. She was miraculous. She was beautiful and powerful and very opinionated and not meek. And I was instantly drawn to her.
And was this a popular record?
Very popular. Yeah, the Fugees were very popular at that time. And it's funny because Lauryn came out with 2, 3, 4, 5 records after that. None of them could compare with that very first record.
Do you still listen to the Fugees?
You bet. Yeah. The Fugees are my Black Eyed Peas. It's like for your generation, that kind of pop rap thing would be Black Eyed Peas. For me, it was the Fugees.
One more track I want to play here, and this is a song by Daft Punk, Get Lucky.
Like the legend of the Phoenix.
Was this an instant classic for you, Hannah?
It was. It was not just an instant classic for me. It was the record that brought people back into record stores.
Really?
For some reason, no one wanted to download this. Everyone wanted the vinyl or everyone wanted the CD. It was one of those records that everyone wanted to own. There was not a wasted note on the record. Even the little interview that they do in the middle with Giorgio Moroder, even that is genius.
Is this a song that lends itself to vinyl, that kind of depth?
All Daft Punk lends itself to vinyl really, really well. You know, their sources are analog. There's a digital top note. But Daft Punk is all about the analog love. Always has been.
I wonder if you've seen this band live.
Oh, I haven't. I would love to. And, you know, it's basically two big guys with a mask, but I'd still love to see it.
There's some other interesting elements going on here, too, though. I mean, there's a lot of kind
of
strands.
Well, Pharrell Williams, there's every influence on Earth. All the influences that we've talked about are all here. And that's what's happening. It's like there's a basket, there's a couple of things in there, and then you throw in a couple more things and a couple more things, and by the end, the basket is full, but it's still cohesive. It's still full of good stuff. And that's, I think, musically speaking, that's where we've come.
Hannah Skrubko, this has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Matt, thank you for having me. It was so much fun.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in November 2016. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. We're up on the